Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Older Americans reported $338 million in losses from fraud through the third quarter of last year. That's an increase of 23% from 2019. And for the first time, online contact outpaced phone contact as the favored connection for scammers, according to an October report from the Federal Trade Commission. Julie Jargon is the family and tech columnist for the Wall Street Journal. She's been covering the issue. Welcome to the show, Julie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so phone contact versus online contact. Is there anything that they point to that explains this change?
Part of the reason for the increase in scammers initiating scams via online contact is because so many adults have been, older Americans have been turning to online shopping. So that's one kind of entry point. A lot of people during the pandemic, not having the typical in-person social connections, have become more active on email and keeping up with people online. And so that's been kind of a new window in for scammers.
So a new window in, but one that they're not necessarily very experienced with.
Exactly.
The National Adult Protective Services Association is warning about online puppy scams and romance scams in seniors. Now, I've heard of romance scams. Those are as old as time, right? But what's the deal with the puppy scams?
Puppy scams, you know, pandemic puppies became very popular during the pandemic, people wanting an animal to provide companionship. And with the online puppy scams, sometimes people have gone online and paid for, you know, an expensive breed of puppy, only to never then receive that puppy. And so it's just another way that, unfortunately, scammers have kind of pulled at the heartstrings of lonely people, promising them something and not delivering, and then, you know, taking their money in the process.
And how has the romance scam changed, you know, morphed for online purposes?
You know, yeah, people will, it can take many forms, but oftentimes someone will receive a friend request over Facebook from someone who, you know, appears to be someone they're not. And a relationship develops online, either through text messaging, sometimes it moves to the phone, but it usually starts in an online social network like that. And you know, it can go on for months sometimes, and you know, people come emotionally attached to someone, and then that person starts asking for money, saying that they've run into some sort of trouble. And once they have that emotional connection with that that person, you know, they start sending in money, and you know, that person wasn't who they said they were.
I suppose that the reporting of this suffers from the same thing that any kind of elder fraud reporting suffers from, and that is embarrassment, right?
That's correct. Yes. A lot of people feel after the fact like they should have known, they should have seen the warning signs, they do feel embarrassed. And so they either don't report it themselves, or they never tell their family members that it happened, because a lot of times the reports come from third parties, from family members who are concerned. So if they don't know about it, they can't report it.
Is there much recourse for people who are scammed in this way?
Unfortunately, there's not. I mean, there are ways to report it. You can report it to the FTC. You can report it to local law enforcement. A lot of people do go down all of those proper reporting paths, only to never find any justice. It's just really hard. Once the money is gone, it's hard to then find the person that was responsible for initiating the scam. The money's been spent. You know, gift card scams are a big thing, where, you know, people purchase a gift card, and once that balance has been removed from the card, it's really hard to trace it and to figure out where that money went. So a lot of times people can lose their life savings. And so that's why it's really important to try to be proactive rather than reactive when these things happen.
Do they have any idea who the scammers are? I mean, not literally exactly who they are, but where they're coming from. Are they domestic? Are they foreign?
It's both. I don't know what the exact breakdown is, but yeah, it can be domestic. It can be from different countries.
The Federal Trade Commission highlighted the trend in the report I mentioned last October, and it also mentioned how the FTC has brought new enforcement actions. What are those?
I'm not sure what the new enforcement actions are. Unfortunately, I don't think I got into that in my column.
Contrary to popular belief, older Americans are not necessarily defrauded at a higher rate than young consumers, but they're targeted more. First of all, why does that misconception persist, and why are they targeted more? I'm not sure I understand the distinction.
I think the reason that people think that older adults are, are victimized more is because there's a perception that older adults aren't as tech savvy as younger ones. But some of these frauds are very sophisticated and, can trick even the most tech savvy person, especially with email frauds. A lot of times you receive an email, it looks very legitimate. It can look like it came from your boss. Sometimes these scammers can find a lot of personal details about their victims through online social media networks. So they can name, the name of a grandchild or provide some personal details that can be, very convincing to someone. So anybody at any time can be a victim. However, I think that the scammers do tend to target older adults because they might be more likely to answer their telephone and not just, screen their calls. And, there is a higher degree of loneliness, especially during the pandemic. And so they're taking advantage of that. However, the fraud losses reported by older Americans does tend to be a higher monetary amount.
There are some ways to determine if an email, for example, is coming from a scammer. What's the thumbnail on what people should look for?
You should look at the actual email address. A legitimate email address is usually fairly simple. If it's coming from your bank, it's like bankname.com, right? But if it's coming from a scammer, there's all sorts of, letters and numbers and gobbledygook up in the email address. It doesn't look legitimate. So you have to really look at the actual email address itself, not just who it says the sender is. And the same is true with websites. If you receive an email and it's directing you to a website, let's say it's your bank saying, you need to pay some money or you need to verify your identity. A bank website is usually pretty simple, www.bankname.com. And so it's really important to look at the actual URL as well.
Cyber safety firm Norton LockLife shows how to unsubscribe from marketing emails. What do we mean by marketing emails? Just all those emails I get from, Macy's? That kind of stuff?
That kind of stuff. Okay. And it's, if you don't want those, it's good to just send it to spam. That way your email system's spam filter can recognize that. So it just cuts down on the amount of stuff incoming that's junk and that might contain something that looks like it's coming from Macy's, but it's really not coming from Macy's. So that can help to kind of just reduce the clutter that's coming into the inbox.
Is much of it coming through Facebook and other social media?
It can. It can come through social media for sure. It just comes through email. It comes through the phone. It's kind of anywhere you can get in touch with someone, you can receive some type of fraudulent, offer or, suggestion.
Yeah. And I don't think that I'm practically older, I'm getting there. When you get a phone call and it tells me that it's probably scam, I just don't answer it.
Right. And that's a great service to have if especially on your mobile phone, if it says expected spam, it doesn't always say that. And so that's why it's a good idea to try to, block out unknown numbers. And there are various ways to do that. There's obviously the do not call registry, which you can sign up for. That is definitely not perfect. So many people still get spam calls even after signing up for that. But there are, you can call your phone service provider for your landline or for your mobile phone. A lot of them have call blocking services that they can add on to block robocalls. You can even do it just on devices themselves. For example, if you have an iPhone, you can silence unknown callers. So anyone that's not on your contact list, if they call you, you'll see that you had a missed call, but it won't ring.
Okay. EverSafe is an app that some financial institutions have recommended. What is that? How does that work?
Yeah, so that is an app that monitors bank and investment accounts, and it does it across institutions. I mean, you can do this with your individual bank. You can, you know, have your bank send you notifications if someone, you know, if a withdrawal has been made that exceeds a certain amount that you decide. But that's only, you know, one bank. And you have to call all your banks to do that. But this app takes into account your spending history. And so it has an AI that's trained to detect changes in behavior. So for example, if you were always paying your bills on time and all of a sudden you've got some late bill payments, or you've missed depositing some checks that you would normally deposit on the same time every month. Mm-hmm. If those things kind of start to happen, you can get a notification that you might want to look into that.
There's a service called DMA Choice. What is that for?
That is a way that you can opt out of receiving pre-screened credit and insurance offers. Huh, so all those offers that come in the mail that say you've been approved for this credit card, if you don't want that and you want to cut down on the ability for maybe other people to get a hold of your mail and sign up for something in your name or steal your identity and sign up for a credit card that's in your name that they're going to use that you never knew about, it's a good idea to just kind of cut down on receiving those kind of incoming offers.
Is it just me, or was one of the silver linings of the economic downfall of 2008 the fact that nobody got credit card applications in the mail anymore?
Well, that could have been a good thing.
Yeah, it was really good. It's cut down on it. It saved a couple trees. Okay, so for people with live-in caregivers, what do you suggest for that?
If you want to make sure that your caregiver can't see documents that might contain personal information, bank information, it's a good idea to switch to electronic bank statements. If you don't want to have those statements coming to your home where they're sitting around, mm-hmm. you can have your mail forwarded to a trusted loved one if you need help going through your mail and organizing your finances, and that way it doesn't come to your home. And the sad thing is that, you know, we think of all of these scams as happening by, you know, people in other countries that are coming in through email and the phone. But the truth is most fraud against seniors is still perpetrated by caregivers and family members.
Yep. And you mentioned gift card scams. What are those? What are you talking about there?
Those are, you know, the scams themselves can take many forms, but the payment option, the payment method is a gift card. So for example, you receive a call from someone saying, hi, I'm your grandson. Grandma, I'm in trouble. And, the police have arrested me and I need to pay post bail or something. Can you go to Walmart and, buy some gift cards and then tell me the code on the back? I need that payment. Now, of course, no police department or anyone is ever going to accept a gift card as a payment for something like that.
Right.
The IRS is not going to accept a gift card as payment for back taxes. That's just not going to happen. But this is happening all the time. And the reason is once that gift card balance is gone, it's gone. There's no way to really trace who it went to. And it's spent very quickly and then it's too late.
Well, Julie Jargon, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Julie Jargon is family and tech columnist for The Wall Street Journal, and she's been covering the fact and the incidents of, for the first time, online contact outpaced phone contact as the favored connection for scammers, especially for older Americans. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When schools pivoted to online learning last March, everyone from teachers, counselors, psychologists, and parents worried about excess screen time. Parents, of course, have been at the front lines with questions about where to draw the line, especially when old rules about limits no longer appear practical with remote learning. One tech expert says that managing the potentially round-the-clock use of screens for kids takes skill and a shift in attitude. Devorah Heitner is the founder of the Raising Digital Natives website. She is an education and technology consultant and author of the 2016 book, Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You advocate for letting kids lead when it comes to their tech consumption. And it kind of made me smile when I read that, because I just was talking to a relative about how they are doing the letting kids lead when about what they eat, you know, as infants. And it's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it also obviously depends what's in the house, right? So if you want to let your kids eat whatever, you also have to think about what's around. And it's the same thing with tech, right? We want to provide them with things that are positive and let them make choices within what's appropriate for their age and ability. But they may turn you on to some things that are amazing. I just did a focus group with families where the parents were saying, oh, my kid found this amazing music program and it's so interesting and I'm learning so much. And I said, oh, what is it? And they said, GarageBand. And I was like, that's great. That's a great discovery for a kid to make, and a great example of letting your kid lead, and it's not down a bad road, right? It's a positive experience. And that's something that your kid can use at 7 or 17, right? So GarageBand could, you know, be the start of something great. Your kid could be, you know, doing this for a long time, and it could be amazing.
Yeah, but we've kind of been, you know, parents have been trained to distrust, to be wary of screen time for one reason being exposure to obscenity, you know, whatever. You know, I just did a show last week, a segment on exposure to drug dealers on social medias, you know, and on Snapchat and all that, or Instagram or whatever it might be. But then also just the being stuck in front of a screen all day, the dangers of that. So you say parents need to be tech positive. So what do you mean by that?
By being tech positive, it's partly about resisting the rush to judgment of themselves or other parents just because kids are using tech, but also getting really curious about what kids are doing with tech. You know, are they learning to make books on a tablet or an iPad? Are they writing fan fiction about their favorite novel series? Or are they watching endless unboxing videos, which is like porn for little kids and is probably going to lead to some tantrums and bad behavior and maybe not so great? So there's a tremendous range of what kids can be doing with their tech. And we really want to look at, you know, are they being creative versus just consuming? If they are they consuming something that's positive or at the baseline? Because we're looking at pandemic parenting, you know, month 12 here in the marathon. Right. Is it just okay? Or is it, you know, really bad? I mean, as you say, you know, obscenities, conversations with people you don't want them to talk to, obviously things like pornography or extreme violence. There's a lot on the computer we might not want our kids to see. So I really look at, you know, YouTube, which is really the Wild West, it could be anything, or TikTok, versus a more controlled universe, you know, where maybe you know what your kids are watching, like a Netflix or a Hulu or the kids' podcast networks or things where you know kind of what they're getting. That's a very different world. Or a game that you know and like, and maybe you've set up a server where they can play with friends. So there's such different experiences. And when we lump everything together into screen time, we're really not being fair to the more positive things kids can do, and also maybe the only way they can connect with peers right now.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about how to change the line or move the line when it comes to screen time for kids. My guest is Devorah Heitner. She's founder of the Raising Digital Natives website, and she's an education and technology consultant and author of the 2016 book, Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. If you have a question or comment about any of this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So how should parents, what kind of measure should parents use when it comes to actual screen time per se, getting to that kind of physiological issue of having your, what regardless of the quality of the programming, do we need to be in front of the screen? I mean, is it good for us?
Absolutely. And a lot of kids are doing remote school or at least having some remote days or doing more of their homework remotely. So we do need to be making sure our kids are also moving, that they're looking away from the screen, looking out the window or going outside. We know that there are both vision and body effects from too much sedentary time staring at a screen. So absolutely, our kids need that balance, and they can be doing more chores right now and contributing to our households, learning some great skills like cooking, or I taught my son how to ball socks. It turns out he didn't know that, you know, folding your own laundry. There's lots that our kids can learn that will be away from the screen right now, and fun activities to do like puzzles or board games or playing instruments. And the screen can be amazing. Kids can be writing stories, composing music, you know, creating things, connecting with friends. So we do have to look at the balance of their day. And are they using tech to connect with others that they may not be seeing, because a lot of kids aren't doing their sports right now, or they're not doing some of the activities that they would usually do. And some kids really thrive on the fun, competitive team qualities of a sport. For example, those kids may be really drawn to video games right now. What we want to make sure is that it's not interfering with sleep, it's not interfering with homework time, that it's not interfering with movement, right? So kids need to move, they need to eat, they need to sleep, they shouldn't be looking at a screen while they're eating, ideally. So we need to be giving them at least, you know, 25 minutes, ideally for, you know, lunch. But I would really look at all the other things they're doing as well and say, is this leaving time for some face-to-face time with the family? Is this leaving time for chores and sleep? And then look at the categories of the ways they're using it. So maybe if you have a tween or a teenager, they might be texting with friends some of the time. They might be learning a new skill. If they're spending time learning chess moves or ukulele, you know, from a YouTube channel, you might put that in a different category than if they're just doing something that feels like it's not feeding them as much or not helping them. And obviously all of us are going to waste a little time. I mean, I think all of us have spent a little time in the pandemic, you know, binge watching on Netflix or whatever. Uh-huh. So I also think we have to really look hard at our own habits and what we're modeling for our kids and be realistic about maybe not every moment is going to be the highest and best use of their time, but we don't want them to spend time on things that are harmful or put them in a really negative mood.
And what's your sense? Obviously, this is a huge universe, but your sense about how teachers are doing when it comes to homework and getting them off the screen to do things in the real world? Because so much is done remotely.
Teachers are giving them some really exciting non-synchronous assignments to go do all sorts of cool things. And unfortunately, that's where we're seeing some of the inequity of, like, some families have the energy and the time to support their kids in doing that. Some folks have art supplies at home, and other families may be really stretched by the pandemic. They may have lost someone. Both parents may be essential workers. Kids may be home alone or actually helping younger siblings with the tech for remote school. So I think it's fair to say that schools are trying to balance their giving kids really cool and interesting things to do with the reality that some kids are not in a great position to take on a lot of independent work right now because of the other demands or what's going on at home. So ideally, kids are being given really pleasurable, interesting things to read. Ideally, families can get books at home, either from the school library or curbside pickup at the local library. And those are amazing resources. We definitely want our kids to, you know, have those grab and go science kits from the library, and we want them to read books. But the reality is the best thing in a kid's life, if they're doing remote school, might be that teacher's face or the classmate's face on the screen. So I think we don't want to denigrate that or feel badly for the kids who are on those Zoom classes. Anything the teacher can do to make those Zoom classes more interesting and more engaging. I've seen a lot of teachers use games to do that, especially with elementary schoolers, and that can be really fun. But this is a really tough time too. So I would say if your child is bored with Zoom school or remote school, and there are projects you can come up with for them to do or that they want to do that are following their interests, it's really great to lead with their interests right now, because the most important thing is we don't want them to disengage from learning.
It was kind of interesting. I was just talking with the superintendent of Columbus City Schools, which is it's the biggest school district in the state, about, I don't know, what, 50, 3,000 or something students, and they've had to pivot very quickly and make sure and now have tablets in the hands of every student that needed them. And then they're also creating buying hotspots, and it raised awareness about the lack of accessibility, the lack of connectiveness, and that a silver lining of this might all be that now people are talking about how to get the city connected so that nobody's left behind. You know, it's easy to talk about too much screen time. Some kids don't get enough to compete.
Absolutely. And when you're dealing with a phone, because a lot of families might have a phone, but maybe not have broadband, then there's a lot less that you can do, you know, and it really does limit you. So I think it is important to think about making sure everyone is on the same playing field and can connect with school. That said, you know, all those tablets going home, we do want to make sure parents know, just because they came from school doesn't mean you can't take them at night and unplug your kid at night, make them go to bed. So even though the kid's saying, well, this is my homework or this is school, it is really important that kids don't stay on that connected device kind of overnight, even if their bedroom may be a good place for them to do quiet work during the day. So it's just an important piece for parents. And I think this happened so fast, it's not surprising a lot of parents were kind of caught up by surprise by how intense kids' relationships with those connected devices can get.
Yeah, you wrote a story in the Washington Post last week titled "Remote School is Stressing Parents Out." Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think the fact of having the teacher talk to your child at home, for some parents, it might trigger memories of their own school experience, so that can be stressful. And then just having this device that you have to monitor even as you're working. Like when my son's finished with his work, he's still got that iPad unless I take it away. But what if I'm on a meeting or a call? So this happens in my home as well. I have a 12-year-old sixth grader. And most of the time he's using the tech pretty well. And, you know, I'm like really feeling pretty good. Like I wrote this book screenwise and here's my 12-year-old. But definitely I found him, you know, off task sometimes. And so it takes a lot for me or my husband, we're both working, to keep an eye on, okay, if the class got let out early, are we taking the device? Are we making sure he's using it in a thoughtful way? How do we nudge him onto some other activities, whether it's Legos or playing outside, right? So what does that look like? And I think for a lot of parents, monitoring the tech throughout the day while their kids are doing remote school while the parents are trying to work is a big job. And hopefully schools are recognizing that and supporting parents in every way they can.
I mean, getting that balance between hovering and, you know, breathing down a kid's neck and helping them with it. Do you think teachers are doing, I mean, obviously they're just like everybody else. They had to pivot. And they've gotten a lot better over the course of the year at how to do assignments, how to communicate with parents about what the expectations are, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the challenge I hear a lot from parents is either under communication or over. So I wrote in that Post article, I was writing about the over communication, the schools where you've got the app notification on and the parents getting 300 emails a day, which is incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
The flip side is I've talked to parents who didn't know their kid was failing three classes, hasn't been showing up to Zoom school, and the parents are working. So again, I think we have to take a non-punitive approach. This isn't anybody's fault. A lot of kids aren't self-directed and don't have the executive function skill to navigate school on their own. And school usually has a lot of external force of like, there's a bell ringing and there's all these cues to go to the next class. It's very easy for kids to either intentionally skip the next class if nobody's watching them or to just space out and be focused on something else. And I mean, we've all missed Zoom meetings where we, you know, if I don't have a calendar reminder going off, I could easily miss a Zoom meeting. So I think it's really important to not expect, you know, a second grader to have the executive function of an adult, right? With all of that, with all of the assistance we all rely on. So a lot of kids are getting really good at setting their own timers and organizing their day with remote school, and that's to be celebrated. But for the kids who are struggling, we need to find ways to help them and also recognize that we can't hold kids super accountable for what they didn't get this year. We just have to support them where they are. And I think we're all going to be playing a lot of support and checking in when kids are back in buildings more full time.
Let's see. We've got a call from Mary. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, I had an idea. It's kept me a little bit amused. I thought it might be good for kids, and that is maps. I just printed out a while ago to do a puzzle a blank map of the United States from a nonprofit or educational site online, and filled in all the state names. Turns out I didn't know where Wyoming was too well. Also, Doctors Without Borders sometimes sends out maps, or you can order some online and just put them on your walls. And, you know, when kids are kind of bored, they're right there on the wall to see then and to look at and to understand when they watch the nightly news where countries are and so forth.
You know, you make me think, thank you, Mary, for that call. It makes me think about doing stuff with your kids online. I mean, with the screens on.
Absolutely. A great way to work with kids with their tech is to say, hey, can you teach me Minecraft, or show me how you would research if we were going to take a road trip and look at that map? How would you do the research? And what's the difference between planning the route on the highway versus if we were going to fly there? And all of these great questions. So absolutely, doing tech with your kids is a great way to also see what they don't know. You know, if they come home with a concern about something they heard on the news, you know, where did they get that from? Did they hear it in a meme? Did somebody give them wrong information?
Uh-huh.
So we want to help our kids be news literate as well and know what sources are good. And, you know, Doctors Without Borders or, you know, a nonprofit geography association might be a good source. There might be other sources that aren't as useful for our kids. So we want to be really smart about that. And some of that can happen asynchronously. So you may not be as available during your child's school day if you have to work, but it may be that you can look at some things together in the evenings or on the weekends. And so ideally families are, you know, kind of flexing around what's possible. Or if you can take a walk with your kid right before they go into a remote school day, that might be the best time for you to, you know, get that check-in time with them.
Then Susan in Omaha. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. You have the greatest show, by the way. But
thank you, Susan.
Anyway, my question is, since most kids have access to television sets, and I'm wondering if the stations could just put on some pre-existing programs that have been sitting in dry dock forever. I'm thinking there's one called Eureka. There's like 5-minute programs of animation to demonstrate algebraic principles, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Any sense about that, Devorah Heitner?
I know that there are some. I know both the PBS and Nickelodeon and some of the other kids' cable networks have worked on some, you know, either bringing back out from the old days, like dry dock, as you say, or, you know, coming up with new programs. I think a lot of us in kids' media are also concerned about kids' social and emotional health right now and concerned about kids who are lonely and isolated or having trauma from this really difficult year. So there's a lot of programming, I think, in the works to think about addressing those issues. And then there's all the old classic PBS, like, you know, Daniel Tiger and other things. I think TV is also a great opener for older kids to talk with their parents about difficult issues, whether you are watching the news with your kid and asking, you know, and they're asking hard questions about what's going on with politics or the virus or environmental things, or if you are watching even a fiction show and maybe that kid or that family is going through a difficult issue, it can really open up a chance to talk with kids about things in a more theoretical way, where it might be tough to say to your teen, you know, oh, have you ever been to a party where there was drinking? But if there's a show on TV where that comes up, you can say, oh, what would you do in that situation? Or how do you think the character handled that? And it takes it a little bit out of giving your child the third degree and moves it into more of a open-ended conversation, which is so important with our kids.
Susan, thanks for the call. Appreciate you listening. Well, we're out of time now. Devorah Heitner, thank you so much for your time, though. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Devorah Heitner is the founder of Raising Digital Natives website, and she's an education and technology consultant. Her 2016 book is titled Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Smart Columbus, presenting Pivot, Central Ohio's free navigation app that is locally designed to help you get around the region using COTA, taxis, scooters, and more. Plan, book, and pay for your trips. It's simple. Download Pivot on Google Play or the App Store today.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A fake video of the Mars Perseverance rover is making the rounds around the web. The video had 17.1 million views on Saturday alone, despite the original being deleted. A new coalition of tech and media companies led by Microsoft, the BBC, and others want to put a stop to such fakery. Here to tell us more is Russell Halley, contributing editor for Android Central. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So I don't even know if I saw the fake one or not. I watched so many videos.
Yesterday, if it had audio attached to it, it was not the real one.
Okay, because you can't hear.
Kind of the big giveaway.
Okay, I don't think I've seen it. What did it? So what were the differences? It was just mainly audio, and that was it.
Yeah, so I mean, the big thing that happened immediately after Perseverance landed was there was a video that shot around the internet that said that there was audio attached to the landing. And so this is based in reality, in that there were actually microphones included in the Perseverance landing. And we did actually get audio yesterday, but that was the first time that we had heard any audio from Mars. But what had happened, the video was actually shots from the Curiosity rover. There was panorama that had been done and then animated so that it looked like a video was kind of panning, and then had some artificially mocked up audio to go with it. And it shared like wildfire. And on the one hand, it's exciting to see so many people genuinely excited about the things that are happening on Mars and the research and exploration that's being done there, but none of it was real. And so that's, you know, that is one of many, many different things that we see kind of every day on the internet. We keep hearing stories about, celebrities and politicians, having artificial tweets being, kind of screenshotted and shared and things like that. And it's been a constant problem for a long time now. And with the advancements in technology to artificially overlay things over someone's face, it's something that we've been warned about for a long time is only going to get worse from here.
You know how I complain about what they name things? I have to say the thing about this new organization headed by Microsoft is called the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity. It doesn't really roll off the tongue. What does it mean? What will it do?
It's just such a snappy thing that everyone is absolutely going to remember. It did eventually get shortened to C2PA, which is equally catchy something that'll definitely stick around for a while. The goal here is to create a set of specifications for video and photos and things that allow people to trace the origin of an image or videos or documents and things like that when they're shared online. This is a huge collaboration between Microsoft and the BBC for something that is called Project Origin between the two organizations. And since then, several other organizations have joined, including Adobe and Intel and a company called TruePic, as well as ARM. To try and work together to create this sort of source of origin for certain kinds of documents and video,
so that you can find out it came from someone in Taiwan versus NASA.
Yeah, that's okay. The genuine goal there. If someone from NASA has shared something, the goal here in say a year from now, when these kind of specifications get rolled out, is that NASA will say, we've published something using these tools, and this is how you can confirm that it came from us.
Okay.
And the idea there being that those tools would be difficult, but likely not impossible, for someone else to kind of mimic and publish from. The goal there would be for official organizations to be able to publish something and have it be confirmed that it came from those organizations.
So just to be clear, is that fake Mars rover video, is that illegal unnecessarily?
It's not. No,
yeah.
It follows under the what's essentially kind of an artistic recreation or it follows under art licensing because it was taking existing content and modifying it to be artful. Now claiming that it is official from NASA is obviously wrong, but still not illegal, especially here in the U.S. The thing there is, NASA had to come out and say, hey, this thing isn't real. But, the number of people who saw it by that point, weren't going to go and verify it.
Well, and that brings me to my next question is you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. I mean, having these specs for video and photo to allow to trace it to its origin is great. But how many people do you think are going to do that?
Yeah, so this is something that makes it easier for news organizations to confirm the validity of, and someone who wants to go through and kind of check something for them to be able to confirm the validity of something. But it's not going to stop, you know, the daily, you know, someone modified someone's you know, Twitter image and screenshotted it and said, hey, look at this thing this person tweeted. You know, those kind of things are not resolved by this. What happens here is a method of verification for things from official sources.
So I guess the thing here is kind of the coalition itself of big shot organizations gathering to do this.
The big thing here is, yeah, a set of technical tools and specifications to make it easier for things to be traced and confirmed as official from any source that wants to be a part of that program. This is by far, you know, not a 100% solution for all of the fake news on the internet, you know, and anyone who claims otherwise is fooling themselves. But this is a great start for, you know, large organizations to be able to share things and say, you know, this for sure came from an official source, which can, in fact, be useful in a lot of different situations.
Google has a new look planned for the next version of Android. There was a developer preview. What did they show you?
Yeah, so Google does this every year, right around this time. They release kind of a preview. If you have one of Google's phones, you can actually install the preview on your phone and take a look at the new changes that are coming. And they make, you know, kind of additions to those changes leading up to the release of their next big phone. This is Android 12, and a big part of the changes coming to Android 12 is a whole new way to look at how things are shared from your phone to other places. For example, your Wi-Fi password. You know, instead of having to go and dig up your Wi-Fi password in a bunch of different places, Google is creating a set of tools to make it so that you can be logged into your laptop and just from your phone say, you know, share my password with my laptop. So if you, instead of having to enter that password into multiple places, you can share it with other trusted devices that you have nearby you. Which is not terribly dissimilar from something that Apple does. If you own, you know, a MacBook and an iPhone and an iPad, you can kind of share in between those things. What makes it a little unique from Google's perspective is being able to share it with things that are not owned and made by Google. You can share it with, you know, a Microsoft computer or a MacBook or something like that, as long as you have, you know, kind of a trusted connection between those devices.
Like some under the hood improvements, as they say, making it easier to copy and paste.
Yeah, so copy and paste is something that we kind of take for granted, especially when it comes to text, but not, you know, super simple when it comes to sharing images. There have been a couple of different attempts from a lot of different companies to try and improve this over time. Apple has done a pretty good job of making it so that you can kind of copy and paste something between Apple things if you want to do that. But again, you know, you kind of have to own Apple everything in order for that to work super well. And mm-hmm. Google's working on an underlying way to you know, copy something, and instead of having to, you know, share it into a message or you know, kind of direct message it to yourself or you know, drop it over Bluetooth or something, to create a wireless way to just kind of send that thing to something that's nearby you.
Is it going to make it any easier? Is any of this going to make it any easier for an Android or Google version of Android, the 12 or whatever, to communicate and do these kind of things between an Android and an Apple?
Yeah, so the goal there, you know, is to make it so that it works with as many different things as possible.
Okay.
And Google has already made some pretty significant strides in being able to share from something made by Google to something made by Apple, as long as you have something from Google installed on that thing. You know, for example, if you have Chrome on your MacBook, you know, being able to share something from your phone to Chrome is quite easy. And being able to expand that functionality is something that Google is working on within Android 12. It's going to have some limits, but it should be a lot more than what you can do right now.
And so there's also a new image format that helps image quality without increasing the file sizes. You mean the file sizes between the origin and where you're sending it, or what?
Yeah, so we've done a really cool thing over the last couple of years as you know, kind of human beings, in that we've made a lot of phones that have really big cameras on them that can take really great photos. And the downside to that is that those photos are now huge. And being able to share them from one thing to another, unless you are doing it over Bluetooth or something, actually takes a lot of time. And it's actually become harder to send multiple images via email because those emails are now much larger. So being able to use a new file format means that you'll be able to take higher quality photos without having that photo be significantly larger in storage size, which will make sending it to multiple places a lot easier. Or at the very least, not more difficult as cameras continue to improve.
Okay, so now is this a catch? Because the review I read said that there are a few, quote, security-focused and behavioral changes. Like what?
Yeah, so this is something that Google and Apple both have been focused on for the last year is kind of improving what are called safety and emergency features and being able to improve, you know, kind of security features. The bottom line there is that Google's going to make it harder for applications to kind of reach in and do things without your permission. But that's likely going to mean more of those little pop-ups that ask you if you're sure you want to do something to make sure that, you know, you're actually the one pushing those buttons and not a piece of software.
Okay. Let's talk about Apple now, I guess. Next in line. It's working on a software update, which ensures your laptop is fully charged before a big event in your calendar. This is this like AI, right?
This sounds like a really kind of weird, obscure thing, but it's actually really exciting when you think about kind of the underlying stuff that's going on here. So laptops have great big batteries. And when you charge a big battery like that, when you plug your MacBook in or when you plug any laptop in, really, the first 80% of that battery charges really quickly. But then the last 20% on purpose charges much slower. And that's because if you do it that way, the battery lasts longer, just kind of the long and short of that. That last 20% charges much slower than the first 80% to make sure that that battery lasts longer.
Okay.
What Apple is doing here is testing some software that makes it so that if you have a big meeting coming up, you have something in your calendar that says, I have this really important thing for the next 2 hours that I'm going to go to, Apple will actually turn off that safety feature and make it so that that last 20% charges faster to make sure that you're ready for that meeting. So if you need to unplug your laptop and go somewhere, the idea is that your calendar will tell your battery, hey, just this once, we need to charge a little faster so that we have access to the whole battery during that meeting.
And the idea of having it charge slower the last 20 minutes to make your battery last longer has to do with making it last longer for an entire day. This is charging it up fully for a big 2 hours upcoming.
Yeah. So to be clear, that last kind of 20% that last 20% that I was referring to is actually to make sure that your battery lasts for multiple years.
To make sure that
your battery lasts, you know, that full time capacity. So what you're sacrificing here is little tiny cuts to your overall battery life. If every once in a while you need to kind of disconnect to go to a big meeting, and the MacBook is kind of breaking that system a little bit and making sure that you're fully charged when that happens, which is genuinely exciting. Like having your computer know what you need and making changes to the way that it works to anticipate you. Is like you said, it is kind of a form of AI in that it's making sure that you're getting kind of the most out of that machine when you need it,
and without any being aware of it, and having to
without
think
being
about
aware
it.
Of it, yeah. Just by having it in your calendar, having you know kind of that change happen. Now there's a possibility that you run into someone like me who has way too many things in their calendar, and so it'd be really interesting to see how Apple distinguishes between just something being in your calendar and something important being in your calendar. But I suspect that that's something that's why this is something being tested and not something that's just rolled out right now.
This is really important going forward to improve battery time, right? Just overall,
this has the potential to impact how. Not just laptops, but phones and lots of other things, kind of impact battery in general. For you as the user to be able to just have something, you know, in your calendar and have your hardware kind of anticipate your need is kind of a big part of the way computing is kind of moving forward.
And just to be sure, clear, this is under development now. Any expectations about a timeline?
If it's something that Apple's going to roll out, it's almost assuredly going to be something that we hear about with the next, you know, kind of version of macOS, which is at the very least a couple of months away. And it's likely to be something we'll hear about later in the year as part of a new line of MacBooks, if it's something that's ready by then.
Gotcha. Well, thanks a lot, Russell Holly, for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
I wish everybody could see you like I see you in some of your get-ups, but too bad, everybody. That's Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central, and that's pretty much it for Tech Tuesday today. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.